Before we start, as usual, if we can spend a few moments looking at the state of our mind and cultivating the altruistic intention so that this session can become beneficial to both oneself and others. And with that, we've been running this a series of conversations for over 2 years now, primarily to create a forum where we can exchange ideas, we can stimulate thoughts on Buddha nature, and through these discussions, promote this concept of Buddha nature, hoping that this may help us to combat some of the problems we see in the world, like negativity bias or wicked world syndrome or self-hatred, depression, and so forth. And it's been wonderful to talk to a lot of people with great knowledge and experience. And today I'm so honored and pleased to have this conversation with David, who I've known for now, I think, good 2 decades and a half or so. And you have been an authority on Buddha nature, particularly in the early Nyingma literature, where I think you see a very interesting theoretical and practical sort of dimensions of Buddha nature. So thank you for really joining us. And as usual, again, I want to start by asking you how you got into great perfection and when did you come across Buddha nature, or what's the personal story behind your engagement in Buddhist studies in general and in early Nyingma literature in particular?
Sure, and thanks so much, Sadra, for hosting this, and Marcus, and your work, and Karma, it's a great joy to talk with you today. I mean, you've been one of my oldest friends back in Buddhist studies and in the Tibetan Himalayan world. So it's great to have a chance to actually talk with you about these topics. So I grew up in Northern Indiana, which was not a place where there was a whole lot of Buddhism. There was no Buddhism whatsoever. There weren't really even any Asian American families for the most part where I grew up, just a couple scattered here and there. And so I didn't grow up with any exposure to that. And it wasn't something in my family household, which was Irish, Italian, Catholic, basically. And so I first encountered Buddhism at the University of Notre Dame, where I got my bachelor's degree. And I just took a couple of courses that were like survey courses around Indian religions or Asian religions or something. And that essentially is what piqued my interest. And so at some point after I graduated, I had the thought that I should study Buddhism, but I didn't have any money. So the best way to get money to go to Asia and study Buddhism was to go to a PhD program. And that's why I ended up in a PhD program. And so I remember the very first day I arrived at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Wisconsin. There's a tower there called Van Hise Hall where the Buddhist studies people were located back then. And I went there for studying summer Tibetan. So it's the first time I was ever had the opportunity to be exposed to the Tibetan language. And on the first day there, we had summer Tibetan with Kamlung Tulku and another person, Brian, I forget Brian's last name. And after a couple of hours of studying, you know, the alphabet, ka, ka, ga, na, and so forth, we went out to this plaza on Van Hise Hall, and I saw someone, I think it was someone who went on to become a close friend, Chad Leach, and he was also in the PhD program at that time. And I saw he had a book, and I said, what's that book? And he said, oh, it's this book called Kindly Bend to Ease Us, and it's a translation of Longchenpa's Semni Nelso by Herbert Gunther. And so I took the book and I looked at it, and that was the first time I ever saw the words of Longchenpa or the words of a Dzogchen text, of course, in translation in English. And after looking at it for about 60 seconds, I said, well, I'll do my PhD on that then. and that's actually how I began with Dzogchen, and that was my first exposure really to the whole notion of Buddha nature and the great perfection and so forth. And so strangely enough, in my life, I often do things like that. I just make snap judgments and it ends up having years and years of consequences. So that was where it all began.
Those years of consequences, were they enjoyable? And at this stage, when you look back at your long career of studying Buddha nature related literature and great perfection, materials. I mean, how do you understand Buddha nature? I think we have quite a number of people in the audience who wouldn't necessarily have a sort of advanced, well-informed understanding of Buddha nature. So if you can share that.
Sure. So, I went through a long period of complete ignorance. So it wasn't like I was, you know, I had someone who gave me tutelage from day one in these particular areas, but rather I just said, that's what I'm going to do. And my teacher at that point was Geshe Lundrup Sopa, who was a very accomplished scholar in the Gelug tradition, who was a professor at the University of Wisconsin. And he was very supportive and kind to me, but he knew nothing whatsoever about these topics of Nyingma traditions and the great perfection and so forth. So it was really, you know, 3 years at Wisconsin, just struggling through reading translations and other kinds of things. And of course, I was doing a lot of other stuff that had nothing to do with Buddha nature or the great perfection. And then I ended up being in Asia more or less for the next 4 years. And that's where I really began to get the opportunity to work with Nyingmapa teachers of various kinds and go through these. But I can still remember in that first year, I think I was going back and forth between Varanasi and Kathmandu. And I didn't really, I was having trouble. I got lots of teachers who I was getting various teachings from, but I couldn't get anybody to read with me what I was trying to read, which was Longchenpa's Sik Dun Se, which is this masterly survey, the treasury of words and meaning of the Sokchen Ningtik tradition, and particularly how Buddha nature plays out in it. And I can still remember back then sitting in my little place by myself trying to read this Tibetan text, which I could make no sense of whatsoever. And it was just, you know, like fantastic visions, not like visions like a meditation, but more just like visions of what this might mean and so forth. So I still have that acute memory back then of trying to struggle through with what is this stuff, you know, without some kind, quiet voice giving me a deliberate exposure to it. And in some ways, I think that was really great because it gave me the chance to be generative. It gave me the chance to really encounter just how uncertain or unknown some of these meanings are, rather than just having someone give me a really clear, patient exegesis and having to sort through that myself, and only gradually over time being able to get access to the competency in Tibetan and the types of teachers and so forth that could help me really understand these. And I still remember the larger issues that I was thinking about with regards to Buddha nature, which I still think of today. And I'll just maybe list those out. So one would be, and these are all pretty obvious questions that have been there about Buddha nature from the start, and that I think Tibetans were struggling with in the 11th and 12th and 13th and 14th century when they wrote the text that I'm most concerned with. One would be, how do we interpret this idea of Buddha nature? You know, do we interpret it literally? Do we interpret it metaphorically as something about essential goodness or capacity for spiritual awakening? And if we don't just go to those metaphoric, abstract explanations, what does it actually mean? Does a Buddha nature have agency? And if it does have agency, what kind of agency does it have? And how does that agency, if it's located within us, how does it relate to our own agency as individuals? And then I also wondered about, how does Buddha nature relate to other forms of what we call the Buddha? How does it relate to the historical Buddha? How does it relate to the capacity of other individuals to become awakened Buddhas? How does it relate to the Buddhas that govern over Pure Lands? And that particularly led me to think a lot about, here's this minute internal dimension we call a Buddha nature. And then there's these visions we have in Mahayana sutras in particular of these vast cosmological Buddhas that are just huge and massive, and they're home to billions of worlds that are in the pores of their skin and arrayed above their joined hands in a stack of galaxies and so forth. So you have this like most internal, intimate form of a Buddha, and then you have this external, vast, cavernous forms of Buddhas. How do they relate to each other? And then finally, what's the implication for practice? This is, of course, in a lot of early Indian Buddha nature scriptures. You read them and you wonder, okay, so what exactly do you do again? Or what's the implications of this for contemplative practice or ritual practice? And on the other side, what's the implication of this for philosophical concerns, concerns about the nature of knowledge and the nature of the mind and how we understand the body and agency and ethics, et cetera? What's the theoretical implications of Buddha nature? Mm-hmm. And finally, I think one of the things that I kept coming back to is, why are so many core Buddhist Buddha nature scriptures characterized by aesthetics? by strongly aesthetic uses of literature, allegories, metaphors, striking images, narratives, as opposed to, you know, like a focus on logical analysis and so forth. And I spent a lot of time thinking about that. Why is that the case? Why is there that convergence? How do we think through such text? What does it mean to do philosophy through such context? So those are just big background questions that I had when I first encountered Indian Buddha nature text, and I brought with me as I began to study Dzogchen materials and see how they began to respond and create entire complex systems that went in very different directions.
Wow, well, you have laid out such a vast, diverse sort of system that Buddha nature is actually, you know, the different ways to look at it and the controversies around them. If we look at how Buddha nature was introduced in Tibet, you know, in the early part of the transmission of Buddhism to Tibet, since you specialize in that area, what sort of form of Buddha nature? I mean, you earlier laid out the different understandings or different aspects of Buddha nature teachings. We know the Buddha nature sutras were mostly translated, but we don't quite know how rigorously they were studied or taught. The Ratnagotra Vibhaga, the classic on Buddha nature, has not reached Tibet then. So what would be the situation of Buddha nature teachings in the early translation period?
Well, I think, as you said, there were some of these great Mahayana classics on Buddha nature that were translated and made available to people. And certainly that's one source of understanding. I think another source of understanding that's just as important is through the tantric materials. And so we have a kind of difficult understanding of the nature of tantra during this time period. Of course, during the 8th and 9th century in particular, because the imperial authorities proscribed certain forms of tantra from being circulated, but we know, in fact, they were translated and circulated and disseminated in a variety of ways. And so they were exposed to these images of Buddhas, which I think is directly pertinent to Buddha nature, through these cosmological visions. We know that Mahavairochana, the Vairochana as this resplendent cosmological Buddha, and the supporting Mahayana sutras and early Vajrayana tantric materials were definitely a core part of imperial Buddhism during this time period. And in addition, there were these other transmissions that were happening that were a bit more subterranean, not approved by the imperial translation houses and so forth, of Mahayoga materials in particular. And there, I think Buddha nature is all over the place. And when I talk about Buddha nature, I'm not necessarily looking for a term such as Tathagata Garbha or its Tibetan equivalent, but I'm looking for what I see as the ideas behind that. And I think that's all over Mahayoga literature from start to finish in terms of thinking about the human body, the human mind, our capacity for enlightenment, the divine nature of our senses, et cetera. So I think they were exposed to that in that way as well. And then even back then, of course, my interest being primarily in the 11th through 14th century with Dzogchen traditions, I'm interested in how Dzogchen began to evolve in Tibet. And I think it evolved in ways that were both reflective about those Mahayana materials, but were also reflective about those tantric materials. And Dzogchen in the beginning was like a creative amalgamation that was drawing upon both of these, which continued right up into the 14th century.
Yeah, so talking about Dzogchen, the Dzogchen teachings or the Dzogchen approach seemed to have a very different way of theorizing and also applying Buddha nature through the Tekche practices. I think you translate that as breakthrough, if I'm not wrong, and then the Thögel direct transcendence practice is unlike even the sort of Anuttara Yoga tantras, other sort of big tantric treatment of Buddha nature theory and practice. The Dzogchen system seemed to have a very different take on actualizing Buddha nature. Can you elaborate a bit on that, how the Dzogchen sort of approach is vis-a-vis Buddha nature?
I think when we think about Sokchen, it's really important to realize that it's a family group of traditions that are very, very different from each other. And so from this time period of the 8th century, when it's pretty clear that Sokchen begins to emerge in Tibet, and then through the 14th century, there are so many different traditions that fall under this category that we now think of as Sokchen. And some of them called themselves as Sokchen. Some of them called themselves primarily by other terms, like they called themselves the Chiti, the Crown Pith, or they called themselves the Yangti Napo, the Black Quintessence, or the Brahmsek, or the cycle of the Brahmins, and the Sokchen Ningtik tradition, or the Seminal Heart tradition. So there were all these different traditions that were bound together. And I think the one that obviously emerged as historically most influential, and which was the one that did the most interesting things, I think by far, with Buddha nature theory and practice, was the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition. And so that's what, when you talk about Taiksha and Tugel, these two forms of contemplative practice that both work directly with Buddha nature ideas and realities, those are both terms and practices that emerge in the 11th century with the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition. And so in the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition, I think the way to start thinking about Buddha nature there is really to think about creation or divine creation, because I think divine creation is what characterizes the way that Dzogchen Ningtik takes Buddha nature and makes it at the very heart of a complex philosophical and contemplative system. And so if we step back and we understand the nature of divine creation for the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition in the 11th century going into the 14th century, then I think everything else begins to fall in place. And so I've spent a lot of time thinking about that, and just to give some basics about it, karmic creation is a more dominant form in Indian Buddhism that we hear a lot about in philosophical circles. It's all over the Abhidharma Kosha and so many other materials, where basically the creation of life, the creation of the worlds, the creation of in general, that the paradigm is a karmic paradigm, that creation happens because of volitionally, emotionally infused volitional acts by life, you know, by body, speech, and mind, and so forth. And the consequences of those actions are what create our bodies, they create our minds, they're what drive us from death across rebirth into reincarnational forms. They also drive the formation of galaxies. You know, they have these notion of four eons, where eons are created, they endure, they're destroyed, and then they're just empty for a long time. And after they're empty for a long time, what causes the galaxy and the worlds to reemerge? It's the stirrings of karmic residue, the residue of all those volitional acts of living beings over time. And so that's something we talk a lot about, like karmic creation and the karmic paradigm, the whole notion of the 12 interdependent links of co-emergent origination, codependent origination, is about karmic consequences and karmic causation and so forth. But there is another model that's all over Indian Buddhism that we don't often kind of thematize enough, and that's a divine model of creation. And that divine model of creation is something that was really transparent in imperial Buddhism in Tibet in the 8th century and the 9th century. We see it with the mandalas, the Mahavrochana mandalas. We see it in the Maha Yoga works, the deity yoga stuff. We see it in the Buddha nature scriptures and so forth. And we also see it in the great visionary Mahayana sutras like the Avatamsaka Sutra and those other sutras that have these beautiful scene setting beginnings of the sutras, where you have these visions of Buddhas across the galaxies that are connected by rays of light, and the notion of pure lands, where Buddhas create pure lands and they engage in divine acts of creation and so forth. So that divine act of creation, I think, is really critical to understanding Sokchen thought and practice. And what they do with it is they ask the question, how do we go from nothing to something? How does the world emerge? How does life emerge? How does the mind emerge? And they go to the emergence of Buddha, of bodies out of Buddhas, the three kaya theory of Buddhas, that there's a Dharmakaya, a Sambhogakaya, and Nirmanakaya. And so the Dharmakaya is this matrix of emptiness. And what happens is out of those, these Pure Land Sambhogakaya Buddhas, these enjoyment Buddhas, they emerge. And that for the Sokchen Ningtik tradition is the very basis of what they think of as the nature of creation, the nature of divine creation. And that's mm-hmm. what Buddha nature is for them. Buddha nature mm-hmm. is the presence of that mm-hmm. divine creation within all forms of life. And it's constantly active. It's not inert. It's constantly mm-hmm. spilling over into these arrays of pure lands and then Nirmanakaya Buddhas and so forth. And so when you look at the philosophical system in the Sokchen Ningtik tradition, you have, I think of it as like nine different places where this divine creation, and I'll stop talking after I give you the nine. So these nine contexts in which this divine creation happens. The first three are about beginnings, the second three are about middles, and the last three are about ends. So in terms of beginnings, cosmogony, how does the world begin? Literally, how does the world begin? And they talk about a primordial ground that's mm-hmm. original purity and spontaneity. And that original ground is nothing in its own right. And yet out of it, the world flows into what's called the appearance of the ground or the presencing of the ground. And it's described as a youthful vase Buddha body in which primordial knowing stirs. And then the seal breaks open in the vase and the world emerges. And what does the world look like? The world looks like a divine set of pure lands. And then if those pure lands are recognized by the awareness that emerges in the same process, then you have enlightenment. If it's not recognized, you have unawareness, marikpa, and you have the emergence of samsara. So cosmogony. And then cosmology. If freedom happens, that's what the story of the primordial Buddha, Samantabhadra, Kundu Sampo, literally all good, the all good Buddha. The all good Buddha is that awareness which in the very beginning of the universe essentially recognizes the nature of those appearances as intrinsically self. And so he or it becomes freed. And so you have this whole story of cosmology and how these worlds then emerge and how that Buddha becomes these massive cosmological Buddhas in which galaxies are held. And then finally, for beginnings, you have embryology. The Sokchen Ningtik tradition talks about the nature of, embryology. When they talk about the formation of the human body, typically Buddhist accounts will talk about karma driving it. But in the Sokchen Ningtik tradition, they talk about two small eyes, the eye of the lamps and the eye of the elements. And the eyes are Buddha eyes. They're used in the honorific form of the word eye. And those Buddha eyes are the presence of the Buddha nature and primordial knowing that actually drive the formation of an embryo in a mother's womb. So you see at every level, the Buddha nature is profoundly active. And then I won't go through the others in detail, but in the middle, physiology. How do they explain the human body? They explain it as a series of channels of light that go throughout the body and through which the Buddha nature in our heart is constantly manifesting and spilling out with gnosis and bodies that run throughout our rays of light or our channels of light in the body. Psychology, when they talk about how the mind works, they talk about the relationship of the Dharmakaya to the Alaya Vijnana, this universal ground of ordinary knowing and cognition. And they say that the primary thing is the Dharmakaya. It's in our heart right now, and it's generating the psychic energy that becomes the Alaya Vijnana, that becomes the basis for ordinary knowing when we fail to recognize it. And then epistemology, how do we know the world? They talk about the senses as gateways of primordial knowing, literally how you translate yeshe, which is the knowing of a Buddha, and that the Buddha nature in our heart projects out through these gateways into the world around us where we can see them. And then finally, the three ends, soteriology, like how do we become enlightened? How do we become liberated? And all of the main contemplative practices in Sokchen are about Buddha nature and how we work with Buddha nature in a contemplative context. And we can talk in more detail about that. And then the second kind of end is dying. So the conventional explanation of dying in Indian Buddhism is you die, then your karma leads you to be rebirth and so forth. And the Sokchen Ningtik explanation of dying is completely different. Instead of saying it's all about karma, they say it's all about the Buddha nature. That in the moment of death, our internal Buddha nature is revealed and we have systemic experiences of it. first in the form of radiant light, and then in the form of peaceful Buddhas and wrathful Buddhas. Mm-hmm. And only if we fail to recognize those, does karma then take over and recreate our birth in samsara. And then finally, in the 11th, 12th century, there's accounts of the final ends of the universe, where it says, like, you know, after endless numbers of bodhisattvas have worked to essentially liberate every sentient being, and there's no sentient being left to be liberated, it says that the Nirmanakaya Buddha's bodies, the emanational bodies, they coil up into the enjoyment bodies, and the enjoyment bodies coil up into the Dharmakaya, and the Dharmakaya coils up into the Dharma Dhatu, the expanse of reality. And finally, all there is primordial knowing, or yeshe, which is a Buddha's knowing. And so anyway, so you can see that's how the whole system originates. It builds an entire system of thought and practice that explains everything in traditional Buddhist topics through the lens of this Buddha nature, which is constantly engaged in divine acts of creation.
Wow. Well, so the ground you're talking about, isn't it? The Shi, which is the Buddha nature, and everything being, as you put it, radiation of the awareness. So almost everything being reduced to Buddha nature, it's, what do you call it? Cell, dung, this expression, radiation. But when that, in actual practice, which you said you'd like to elaborate more, how you actualize that ground reality, the Buddha nature, especially in the Nyingthig tradition, you have these two main contemplative traditions, right? The breakthrough and the direct transcendence. So what are the specific sort of techniques these two different practices use? For instance, for direct transcendence, you talk a lot about how light is being used, especially light being channeled from the heart through the eyes into the physical sort of world. How is that presented in the Nyingthig teachings?
So one of the most
applying them,
right? Yeah. So that question of practice, which has always befuddled many people looking at Buddha nature stuff in India, where you wonder, like, so what's the practical implications of this? Is it just a, you know, are these Tony Robbins style sutras just inspirational talks, like you can be a Buddha too, and so forth? Or are there actual consequences for how we go about practice? And is there a kind of agency within us that we're engaging in these contemplative practices that are Buddha nature based? And I think the core thing around that is the question of effort and effortlessness. And what does effortlessness look like in the context of Buddhist meditation? If the agency is primarily with this internal Buddha nature that, like you said, has this capacity to be expressive, cell, effulgent, dong, adorning, gen. If Buddha nature is active like that, and it has the agency, and it's what's expressive, what do we do? Do we just like stop obscuring it and relax and let go, and this naturally happens? And so this question of how effort and effortlessness can relate to each other around Buddha nature and practice, I think, is at the very core of these practices. And so the breakthrough practice is one that, is very interesting. If you look at the text, putting aside the issue about how it's taught, and it's taught in many ways. You know, people will often receive it in one way and say, oh, you don't understand how it's taught. Well, I mean, I don't understand all the ways it's taught. No, I don't. But I certainly understand a number of the ways it's been taught. And they're taught in very different ways. And so people sometimes get a little bit doctrinaire about, like, that's how my teacher taught me. Well, that's great. That's meaningful for you. And it's meaningful for them. And it's not even necessarily how they teach it. It's how they taught it to you. So the text, one of the things that characterizes the early literature about breakthrough meditation, or taiksha, which literally means cutting through rigidity or cutting through resistance, is that it's highly aesthetic in character, just like the early Buddha nature scriptures, which have so much like aesthetic language, you know, beautiful, interesting allegories, symbolic decodings, metaphors, striking images. And that's what taiksha texts primarily talk about taiksha meditation. They don't say, oh, do this and do that and give you all these techniques and procedures that you're supposed to do. That's not the way that breakthrough meditation is presented in the early literature. Instead, it's these highly aesthetic presentations of images, evocative symbols, the five kinds of freedom, primordial freedom, naked freedom, freedom from constraints, and so forth. And so, I've thought a lot about, like, how are we supposed to understand this, and how does it relate to Buddha nature? And I've tended to think of these as basically about emergent experiences. So it's not about using techniques to, like, script through a series of procedural actions that produce experiences, but rather it presumes you're already having these experiences. Perhaps you've already done a lot of practices, and at this point you don't need those techniques and procedures, but you need ways to work through these emergent experiences that you're having, or perhaps you have a natural disposition. At any rate, how do we work through these emergent experiences, which in the Nyingma literature are typically put into a threefold set of radiance, bliss, and non-conceptuality, Daesel, Mitokpa. And so I think of Taiksha practice as really primarily focused on how do we work with emergent experiences, and how can we draw upon highly aesthetic forms of language and also visual symbols to help people make sense of these experiences without falling back on, like, technical procedural instruction, do this, do that, and so forth. And that really it's about the idea is that you're trying to have an experience of this internal Buddha nature without drawing upon these procedural set of actions that characterize things like deity yoga, which are very complex. Do this, do that, dissolve this, visualize this, do this with your hands, et cetera. Or the variety of subtle body practices, which are called perfection phase or completion phase practices, where you're told, do this breathing, do this posture, visualize this channel, move this colored sphere from here to there in conjunction with your breath, and so forth. So many different instructions. But here the idea is Buddha nature is your primary reality. It's not something that you're creating. It's not something that's inert and still that you're having to just dig through and find and wake up and so forth. It's already awake. The issue is you don't recognize it. You don't see it. And under the conditions of non-recognition, you've created, a typical metaphor they'll use is like a very complicated metaphor of the sun and light and clouds and so forth, and how the rain falls and the sun hits the rain and it produces clouds and the clouds obscure the sun. And then we think somehow the sun isn't dynamic and active because we don't see it. So in the same way, the Buddha nature within our hearts, and typically they'll say there's the peaceful deities in our hearts and the wrathful deities in our crown. And so the heart's called citta, palace. Citta is just the Tibetan transliteration of the Sanskrit word citta, which means mind. But here it means the spirit mind, the heart mind. And that's the 42 peaceful deities, which is how Buddha nature manifests in the heart. And then Buddha nature manifests in the head, which is called the conch chamber, because like a conch, the skull is white and smooth and so forth. So in the conch chamber, you have the 58 wrathful deities. So breakthrough meditation is, in the absence of any procedural instructions, just essentially understanding and working with these emergent experiences that we're having of that Buddha nature. How do we proceed? And then the direct transcendence is very different. So typically they'll talk about breakthrough as an effortless practice, because there's no effort applied in the sense of procedural instructions and actions. And they'll call direct transcendence an effortful practice, because there are processes, there are procedures, there are focuses, there are postures that you hold your body in, there are things that you focus your mind on, etc. And there are adjustments that you make depending upon what your experience are. But the basic idea, without going into it in great detail, is that you have three different contexts. You can look at the sun, you can look at the sky, and actually talks about looking at lamps, but you can also look in complete darkness with open eyes, and you wait. You do not visualize, you don't force the appearance of anything, but you wait. And the idea is that our internal Buddha nature, which is constantly manifesting in our body, will begin to flood our perceptual field of experience, and we'll begin to see it. So rather than it being clouded by all of these karmic projections and emotionally distorted projections, we actually see the undiluted, spontaneous self-presentation of the Buddha nature within our heart as it flows through these internal channels, which are called nirvana channels. So the typical body, subtle body that has the three channels, those are called samsaric channels. And it's said that there's a series of light channels that are called nirvanic channels, and the Buddha nature flows through them, through our eyes, into the space around us, and we begin to see visions of Buddhas. And there's a lot more details, of course, to the practice than that, but you can see that that's 100% a version of thinking, what does Buddha nature mean as a contemplative practice that has procedures? Well, if it's within our heart, how can we coax it forth? How can we let it flow forth into our perceptual field of experience?
I think it's quite clear. It comes out very clearly that the effort is, well, not the effort, actually. There is no effort in most practices. It's a system without contrivance and without much effort is how it's often characterized. But the point is really to rest in the natural state of the ground, the Buddha nature, isn't it? That seems to be the focus. But when you look at the Nyingma Tantric literature, the Dzogchen literature through ages, then you see the rise of also funerary applications of Dzogchen teachings. You see practices similar to deity yoga and subtle body practices coming in as well. So can you talk about the evolution of these Buddha nature, Dzogchen practices in bringing out inner Buddha nature? How have they changed from the 11th to the 14th century?
So from my perspective, and that's all I can really talk about, they have changed dramatically from the 11th century all the way up into the 21st century. The Dzogchen Ningtik that we see in the 11th century is fundamentally and radically different from what we see with Longchenpa in the 14th century. And what we see with him is very, very different from what we see with, for example, Jigme Lingpa. And then there's many other traditions like the Yangti Nakpo, which I've been doing a lot of work on recently, that supposedly goes back to the 14th, 15th century with a guy named Dungso Rapa, the elder, or the younger, and then continues into the 19th, 20th, and 21st century. That's also a very different tradition. So like there's so many different things that happen, but I'll give you just some of the highlights. The first one is when you look back at the 11th century and 12th century, and you look at the foundations of the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition, it is profoundly oriented towards the senses and towards a kind of theology and practice of the material elements. Material elements meaning Sachu, Meilung, Namka, Sachu, earth, water, fire, wind, and then sometimes you add space as the fifth. Dzogchen Ningtik in the 11th and 12th century is like fundamentally oriented around thinking about those material elements. The practices, the philosophical system, it goes on and on at great length about the elements. And it manifests in very particular ways, like in terms of practices. I mean, the Tugel practice 100% is there for sure, but there's all these other practices that work with your senses and material reality as a way to build a kind of meaningful contemplative life. Now, the most famous versions of those practices, which are known later on, are what are called the listening to the sounds of the four elements or five elements, four or five. And that's this practice where later it gets talked about as a preliminary practice for the Tugel meditation, where essentially you go off into nature and you find naturally occurring forms of water and fire and wind and water and earth, and you listen to them. And you listen to them for like months on end. I mean, it's an incredibly immersive practice. Mm-hmm. And at some point, you begin to hear cosmological voices. Like in the sounds of those elements, you begin to hear the sounds of dakinis, of Buddhas, of demons, and all these other kinds of things. But those are not the only practices of material elements in the early Dzogchen Ningtik tradition. You have practices about how do you taste the elements? How do you smell the elements? How do you touch the elements and so forth? And there's all these recipes. For example, there are recipes that tell you, hey, put this together with this, with this, with this, mix it up, bury it in the ground for 3 days, pull it out and smell it. And that's called, smelling the scent of the four elements. And then there's this whole complex philosophical system around the elements and how they work with time, how they relate to the changes of the seasons, the changes of time in a particular day, the changes of the years over the 12-year kind of calendar. And they also talk about bodies. Like everybody has a body that's dominated by a certain element. So you can say, oh, I'm a yogi with a body of water, or she's a yogini with the body of fire. And depending upon which element dominates in your body, you're told to do different kinds of practices at different kinds of the day and so forth. And there's also just a lot of other orientation around our physical senses, not just our visual sense, which is what dominates later Dzogchen traditions, but our physical senses. So I spend a lot of my time back in those traditions, which I've really grown to love. And when I compare those to Longchenpa, which was really, what I spent all my 20s and 30s kind of studying primarily, and who I still love, I see it as being very, very different. Longchenpa has really fundamentally changed the tradition. And the thing about Longchenpa is you see everything that was there in the older tradition. Like I think of him as an encyclopedist. He doesn't leave anything out for the most part. Like he keeps stuff, but you can sense, at least I can sense, I do sense that it's not aligned with him. Like he doesn't have the same passion for the elements and for these sensory practices and so forth. Mm-hmm. Like his passions are elsewhere. And so even though the materials are still there, the passion and the interest has shifted register. I think he's much more focused on the Togyal meditation and the Taiktrim meditation and a relatively slim set of preliminary practices that go hand in hand with it. He's much more focused on his vision of bodhicitta, of the enlightened mind, than he is of this kind of transformation of matter and the senses and so forth. So I just think it's a very different tradition, which it's taken me a long time to appreciate that. And I remember many years ago, I was studying these earlier texts, and I was talking to Ron Davidson, a well-known Tibetologist and Indologist of Tantric Buddhism. And he said, well, don't think that Longchenpa is saying the same thing as those 17 tantras, which were the canonical basis of Nyingtik in the 11th century. And it's a very obvious comment because Longchenpa is 300 years later and he's got his own agenda and so forth. But for me, it was a really important moment because I thought, that's a good point, And so I started looking at those older traditions, not through the filter of Longchenpa, but in their own right. And then we zoom forward to Jigme Lingpa, for example, to mention, probably the most famous Dzogchen figure in the last three centuries. It's just very, very different in character. What he's doing is so different from Longchenpa. He's much more interested in sadhanas and in deity yoga and thinking about the possibilities of deity yoga as an individual and a collective process practice and how we could change those or transform those in relationship to kind of Dzogchen Nyingtik principles and so on. And he doesn't seem to have a whole lot of interest in the material theology or the material practices and the sensory practices. He very famously said, even those sounds of the element practices, he says nobody does these anymore and, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very different system. Like Longchenpa preserves everything, but when you get to Jigme Lingpa and you compare that to 11th, 12th century Nyingtik practices and thought systems, I mean, yes, there's continuity, but it's very, very different. And then when you zoom forward to Mipham, whose primary goal seems to be to work out this philosophical system in relationship to other Tibetan Buddhist sects, I mean, it's just, again, very, very different from the older traditions. That said, we don't have time to get into this today. There are a lot of other diversity that's happening. And one of the things that's been very revelatory for me over the past couple of years is James Gentry and I started to decide, hey, let's review all of the dark retreat literature. Let's look at all the ways the Nyingma tradition worked with darkness as a contemplative practice for these visionary practices of Togyal. And that led us gradually to this Yangti Nakpo tradition, which is so different in character from these other Dzogchen traditions. And that's pretty late. We don't know how much of it goes back to the 15th century, but clearly it gets revived and so, you know, re-revealed in the 19th and 20th century. And that's just a very different and very interesting twist. And I think there's many other stories to be told about how Dzogchen is just not one thing, even though in the last 30 or 40 years, I think our dominant ways of talking are to say, oh, this is what Dzogchen is. It's about Taiksha and Togel, and there's these preliminary practices that you do, like the Core de Rushen, the differentiation of samsara and nirvana, where you act crazily, and the sounds of the elements, and then these preliminaries of body, speech, and mind, where you visualize whooms in different ways and so forth. And that's all great, and that all goes back a long time, 1,000 years ago, but there's many other changes that happen over time.
Well, wonderful. I suppose all this diversity and the changes that happen are, in fact, themselves sort of allowed by the openness, the flexibility, the dynamism that is sort of part of the great perfection tradition. I think at this point, maybe we'll take questions from the audience. If there are questions posted on Zoom or on Facebook.
Sure, Marcus, yes, there are a number of questions definitely coming through. Let's see. So since you were just talking, David, about your work with the Yangti Nakpo stuff, there's a question about your current work. David, I've been enjoying reading through your articles on Dzogchen. There are many references in those articles to future sustained examinations of certain topics, for instance, your history of Dzogchen. I wondered if you were still working on that material or if you had future Dzogchen publications that you're working on. So I guess they're just asking what you're doing now.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay. So my life's a little bit complicated. So like many years ago, I wrote 4 large books and completed them. One was a translation and annotation of Longchenpa's The Treasury of Words and Meaning. One was a kind of philosophical contemplative look at the Dzogchen Ningtik and all its various aspects. One was looking at cosmological traditions and how they manifested in Longchenpa's life. And that's a third book. And a fourth book was a very deep dive into the scriptures and literature and how they all relate to each other and so on. And then what happened was 2 things. One, like all those years, I'd been looking for commentaries on the 17 tantras, which are the original scriptural base of the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition. And they manifested about 15 years ago or so, or 20 years ago. And suddenly I had like 5,000 pages of commentary on the text that I'd been working with, these terse, aphoristic scriptural tantras. And they were not easy to read. They're challenging. And so I thought like, oh, I don't want to publish these when I have these books I should read, but they weren't like a hop, skip, and a jump to read. And then the other thing that happened was at that point, I began to go back to Karma's way of framing this gathering today. You know, to me, the question I keep asking myself is, how am I beneficial to people in this world? And I felt a deep commitment to Tibetan people and Himalayan people. And I felt the need to work on that and not simply to be a professor and publish books and so forth. And so I've spent many years of my life doing work back in Tibet that have nothing to do with Buddhism, with entrepreneurship, education, technology, and so forth. And so the combination of those 2 things really detoured me for a while. And then about 11 years ago, we had the opportunity at the University of Virginia to start something in regards to contemplation. And so we started what has become one of the largest centers in the world, focused on thinking about contemplation in the context of our educational systems, the Contemplative Science Center. And that was a lot of work too, but it did bring me back to thinking about contemplation and working at it in an applied context, and also brought me back from Asia to focus on the United States as well. And so over the last 4 years, I've been able to successfully gradually get myself back into the world of creating and writing text and so forth. And so unfortunately, I started new projects like the Dark Retreat project that James and I are working on. But I am now working back on these things, and I'm working back on those commentaries on the 17 tantras, which I spend a lot of hours every week with various people around the country working on, trying to translate. And so I have a series of leaves over the next 4 years where, even while I continue to help with the Contemplative Science Center, I'm going to be producing those books finally. So those things will start to emerge. I just finished a piece on divine creation that will come out in this volume in honor of Janet Gatso, I guess, next year. I've also finishing up a big piece on effort and effortlessness that will come out in a journal, hopefully before the year is over. So that's kind of where things are.
Wonderful. Thank you. I'm looking forward to a lot of that. That's some exciting stuff, actually.
Yeah, me too.
We've been waiting quite a while for some of these things. So thank you. So how about a more technical question? John Newman says, illuminating talk, David, thanks. Reminds me of when we puzzled over Kadak back in ancient times. How does Ji in Dzogchen relate to Dempani in Madhyamaka?
Well, it's a question from one of my teachers, John Newman. So I owe a great debt of gratitude to John Newman, who was super helpful to me when I was a beginning graduate student at the University of Wisconsin. And his work on Kala Chakras, which I know he's not asking about, but was really influential for me. And John, I would love to talk with you at some point about that, because I really see clearer and clearer the deep interconnection of Kala Chakra and the Dzogchen Nyingting. They're both 11th century productions, and they're both circulating in Tibet. And it's very clear to me that the interrelationship and interdependence between them runs extremely deep. So that's a really important topic that I've been thinking about as well. In terms of Kadak, so Kadak literally means purity from the letter Ka, which is the first letter of the Tibetan alphabet. So sometimes people say alpha purity, you know, it's purity of A. I translate it as original purity or originary purity. I can't remember anymore. But so it's a term that's used to describe this character of the ground. The ground is the Shi. It literally means a ground in the sense of a foundation or a platform or a basis or a ground. I think some people translate it as basis, some people translate it as ground. And that's this notion that this is the primordial nature of reality. It's the ground. Before there's anything manifest, there's this ground. And so sometimes the ground is understood as tantamount to a theory of emptiness, which I think is completely appropriate in fear. I'm sorry, and completely appropriate. So the ground is a Dzogchen Nyingtig way of thinking about emptiness and theorizing emptiness. And so they talk about it in several different ways. And then ultimately the ground is explicitly said to be the Tathagata Garbha. So there's an explicit correlation of the ground to the Tathagata Garbha. And the ground is talked about cosmologically as what precedes the origins of samsara and nirvana, but the ground is also located in our hearts as the Tathagata Garbha, from which our body and minds are constantly self-emerging. So one way that they talk about the ground is Kadak and Lundrup. So originally pure and spontaneously dynamic. So originally pure is really another word for emptiness in a limited sense of emptiness. And spontaneity is a word for manifestation and dynamism and so forth. But really, I would think of Kadak not about as emptiness, but rather as Kadak and Lundrup together is what constitutes emptiness for the Dzogchen Nyingtig tradition. It's the co-emergence of this deep state of openness and nothingness together with this deep state of dynamic capacity for self-expression. That's for them what emptiness is. And the other way they talk about emptiness or the ground, which I think it uses the word empty, but again, I think the ground overall is really their model of emptiness, is they say, no otomba rangshin selwa tukche kunkyap, which means empty in essence, radiant in nature, and all pervading in compassion. And those threefold aspects of the ground are the other dominant way of representing the ground. So I see that as a way of theorizing emptiness, that emptiness is both empty in character, but it's also radiant in nature, and it's also resonant and capable of awareness, intelligent. And in fact, they gloss all pervading compassion, that third aspect of the ground, as having a nucleus, the same word for Tathagata Garbha, a garbha, of awareness, rikpa, that that's what that means. And so the way that I would understand that is their theory of emptiness is that emptiness is both empty, but simultaneously radiant and simultaneously dynamically expressing itself and intelligent and aware in character. That's how they see these things. And so when I think we compare the notions of emptiness there to like the two truths and Madhyamaka and so forth, that's how we need to think about it. Now, if we think about the issue of like the ultimate and the conventional truth and so forth, there Sokchen Ningtik has a much more nuanced position than the earlier Sokchen traditions, which sometimes you might look at and say, my God, what happened to the conventional truth at all? You know, it's all about the ultimate truth. Like, can't understand what practice is, can't understand what a coherent philosophical system is and so forth. And so I think in the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition, you really have a serious, rigorous thinking through of the entire philosophical system. It's very, very detailed in character. But when we look at the two truths in particular, I think those map off best into two orders of reality for the Dzogchen Ningtik, which is represented by karma, which is really the conventional truth, and primordial knowing, or yeshe, which is the ultimate truth. And that's the duality that governs the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition. That's the challenge they see. How are these two related to each other? How do we understand the karmic model of creation and reality and the Gnostic, or the yeshe, the jnana, the primordial knowing level of reality? And so when they look at like all these ways of talking about the body and the mind and so forth, they keep saying the primary reality is the reality of primordial knowing. And that reality of primordial knowing is empty in character, but it is dynamic and self-organizing in expression. And it is the primary reality right now in our bodies, in our minds, in our world. And the karmic reality is a second order reality, because when we fail to recognize what's happening and we create dualism and dichotomization and so forth, then this karmic reality goes into effect. But it's like the clouds that hide the sun, but the sun is still there happening and doing all the work, but the clouds temporarily hide it from view. So that's how I would understand the two truths in Madhyamaka in relationship to the Dzogchen Ningtik system.
Mm. I mean, are there any references to the ultimate truth in the Madhyamaka context and sort of relate that to Gada? The only person I can think of is Mipham, who makes clear statement the Kadak of Dzogchen is something that one has to explore through Prasangika Madhyamika sort of reasoning.
Yeah. You do, of course, in Longchenpa get comments about Prasangika Madhyamika and so forth. And but I think in the end he's not that interested in Mipham's project. I mean, you know, Mipham's interested in this project of like, let's take these great Mahayana philosophical systems that everybody else is working on, and let's introduce a distinctively Dzogchen-based philosophical perspective on there. And it's a great project, but that's not Longchenpa's project. Longchenpa's project is more like, I'm going to give you this vision of all the different great Buddhist philosophical traditions and practical traditions. But in the end, what I really care about is Dzogchen, and that's what I'm going to talk about. And so for him, Prasangika Madhyamaka is left behind. It's a lower order thought system. It's one that he will say is it's great. It's the dominant, the most important way to think about emptiness in a Mahayana context. But for him, it's superseded by how Dzogchen Ningtik thinks about those things. And I think that's the difference between Longchenpa and Mipham. So in many ways, they're very consonant with each other. But in other ways, they're very different from each other. So I think if I was to, you know, imagine how Longchenpa might answer that if he was in the 21st century and was having this conversation, my thought would be that he would say that Prasangika Madhyamaka is an inadequate understanding of emptiness, but it's the best thing you have in the context of Mahayana philosophical thought. Mm-hmm. In fact, there's one really beautiful passage, I forget where it is exactly, but he critiques Chandrakirti, where he's talking about the nature of, I can't remember exactly verbatim the quote, but I remember more or less what the thrust was. He says that for Chandrakirti, Buddha manifestation looks like it's either the leftover of aspirations the Buddha made while he was a bodhisattva to benefit other living beings, or it's the effect of the karmic needs of his followers and so forth. And Longchenpa says, that's just not adequate. The Buddha and the Buddha nature and the Buddha him or them herself are intrinsically dynamic in character. They don't need the leftovers of their aspirations, their bodhicitta aspirations as a bodhisattva. They don't need their followers' karmic engagements and so forth in order to be expressive or manifest, because that's an emptiness is inherently dynamic in character. And that's where he's going to criticize the Prasangika Madhyamaka.
Right. Wow. Interesting stuff. So there's a lot of questions coming in from Facebook and on Zoom. So I'll try to answer one from Facebook, as we haven't had one yet. So maybe I can combine a couple here. So one question is about your comment about Dzogchen literature tending more towards aesthetics rather than logical analysis. And someone's asking specifically about the Vajra or diamond as a metaphor for Buddha nature. Maybe you could speak a little bit about that.
So on the first question, I mean, definitely I'm biased because I'm not someone who shies away from analytical thought or logical thought. I mean, it's actually what comes easiest for me. But I must say, from a very early age, I was predisposed to the arts, and particularly towards literary arts, poetry, fiction, novels, et cetera, and also other kinds of arts, visual arts, performing arts, and so forth. And so what I always kind of wondered about as a child was, like, what kind of rigor is applicable in the type of experience and the type of processing we do when we read a poem, like a poem that is evocative, like Longchenpa's The Chuyingzi, The Treasury of the Expanse of Reality, or we read the Dueno Elegies of Rilke, and we feel these strong sentiments. We feel like we're learning something, but it's not the kind of learning we have when we go through like a rational argumentation that puts out the grounds for our basis and, you know, goes through these formal processes and so forth. And yet to me, it felt at least, and for me personally, more transformative than the kind of effect that reasoned argumentation had on me. So I was always interested, how do these two relate to each other? How do they compare? And how can we understand the different kinds of rigor that apply in both of those contexts? How can logic be a transformative force for you and one that applies to contemplation, but also how can aesthetic experience be a transformative force for you? So one of the reasons that when I first picked up that Longchenpa's translation by Gunther and was immediately drawn to it was poetry, because I was looking at the poetry. And while Gunther's translations had some issues, there was some beautiful translation of the poetry in there as well. And that appealed to me immediately. Like, I recognized this is a philosophical poet or a poetic philosopher. It was someone who saw the convergence of those two together. And that's what really, I think, moves me the most is when philosophy and poetry kind of come together. Now, that said, Longchenpa does a lot of scholastic writing. I mean, you know, he produced thousands of pages of books, which I've read. And even when you go back and you read the those early commentaries on the 17 Tantras, I mean, those are scholastic to the nth degree. Like the most important Sokchen Ningtig Tantra is called the Dra Telgyur, which is a really complicated thing how you translate that, but I translate it as the Tantra of Unimpeded Sound. Although I'm currently working with Adam Little on a very long explanation of how to understand that title. The commentary is 2000 pages long, and it's a commentary on every single word. And it's just like, okay, first question, there's five subtopics and four subtopics and sub-subtopics and et cetera. It's a totally scholastic work. So it's not that Sokchen literature isn't full of scholastic work. And even often they'll go through logical argumentation and debate structures, but the animating spirit of the work is really, I think, more in creative uses of literature, in allegories and striking images and poetic turns of speech and so forth. And particularly in exploring the etymological roots of the Tibetan language. Like, well, people often wonder, like, why do you translate things that way? Well, that's how the Tibetans understood those texts. When they had the word yeshe, for example, they meant primordial knowing. And they explained it that way all the time. And when they said like lugugu, which people have gotten mad at me about for little lynx lambs, that's exactly what they understood that to mean. So like every word and every term, they were constantly deconstructing and exploring, going into flights of fancy and then coming back to the reality of a practice and so forth. They were working through the medium of Tibetan language, even as they were going through deeply experiential kinds of practices and so forth. So to me, in those first four centuries, 11th, 12th, 13th, 14th century, poetry and creative uses of literary aesthetics are what are the driving force of the tradition, even though there is a lot of scholastic literature that's explaining that tradition. So, and I think that for them, it was crucial to how their thinking evolved in the way that you could work with Buddha nature, this internal hidden dimension that we want to get at. For them, you're not going to reason your way there, but you could through, you know, aesthetic uses of visual materials and literary materials and language and so forth, you could find your way there in a much better way than through reasoned argumentation. I mean, I think that's very clear, but how to explain the way that works, that's more complicated. If you look at Longchenpa's writings, they divide up his Sokchen writings. I would divide them up really coarsely into three groups. There's the scholastic writings, which are like the Tsikdunse and the Taekchokse, the treasury of words and meanings, the treasury of the supreme vehicle, the Sapdun Gyatso, the great the ocean of profound meaning. So and a couple of others. These are his great scholastic works. And they're just very, you know, philosophical in a more conventional way. They're prose oriented. There's a lot of citations. It's very complicated. He makes a lot of finely tuned nuances. And then you have his other writings in the so-called Ningtik Yapshi, or the four-part Ningtik corpus. And some of those are the scholastic works, but the other parts are more practice-oriented. And so they provide a lot of detail about, like, here's the history of the tradition, here's the sadhana, here's how you do this practice, here's more background information for how you do Tugel, et cetera, et cetera. And then the really great works of Longchenpa's life, I think, I'm personal bias, are the poetic works of philosophy. And those are the Chöyingtse and the Neilukse in his seven treasuries, the treasury of the expansive reality, the treasury of the abiding reality, and the poetic root verses of the Nelso Korsum, the trilogy of relaxation, and the Rangdrul Korsum, the trilogy of self-freedom, which are just like mind-blowing, exquisite works of poetry. But they're works that are totally rigorous. I mean, the way in which language is used and thought and experience is threaded throughout those is just phenomenal. And while the scholastic works are super interesting to a person like me who's, you know, interested in all the details of everything, I mean, I think those works are far more powerful and have been more influential on Tibetans over time. The Vajra as a metaphor for Buddha nature, that's pretty clear in the Dzogchen Ningtik tradition. It's most clearly expressed in terms of the the Wusel Dorje Ningpo, is that what it is? Like the nucleus or the core of the radiant adamantine reality. Mm-hmm. That's a key expression in the tradition from the beginning. And that really is another way of expressing, of being expressed as Buddha nature. Now, if you look in the treasury of the words and meanings, the third chapter is about Buddha nature. So the most famous scholastic structuring of Dzogchen thought is the so-called 11 topics. And those 11 topics are said to be the 11 topics of the Wusel Dorje Ningpo, the Vajra luminous, the luminous Vajra core. So what's the 11 topics of that? It's the ground, it's the strain from the ground, which is the formation of samsara. It's the pervasion of human existence by Buddha nature. That's the third topic. And then the other topics go into the other stuff. But that third topic, when you look at how he talks about it, that's where he cites classical Buddha nature scriptures. That's where he cites the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, the Uttara Tantra, etc. And he gives those classic Buddha nature allegories that come from Indian literature. And it looks very conventional. And in many ways, it is conventional. But the thing is, that's only the third chapter. He's really just kind of pointing out how this relates to the Mahayana Buddha nature thought. The entire book is about Buddha nature, not just that one chapter where he talks about the Tathagata Garbha and quotes the classic Indian literature on it. So, and the way he frames it at the beginning is it's about the Vajra, the luminous Vajra essence, or the luminous Vajra core, which is, again, the Dzogchen Nyingtyik understanding of the Tathagata Garbha, or the Buddha nature. So in terms of, I think the question was asking about a broader history of that, that I couldn't answer. I mean, I'm not sure like when in Indian literature, where there are places where the Vajra is given explicitly as a euphemism or a simile or just another term for Buddha nature. I don't know that answer, but I do know that in the 11th century in the Dzogchen Nyingtyik, it's very explicit.
Thank you. So you've talked a little bit about the differences between Longchenpa and Jigme Lingpa, and there's a question about that. Is Jigme Lingpa considered a tertian for Longchenpa's material? And if so, why were the teachings lost between Longchenpa and Jigme Lingpa?
Well, I must say, I'm not like, I think for many years, I kind of saw a cliff after the 14th century. And, you know, I skipped to the 20th century and 21st century. So, you know, working with my own teachers and so forth. But the actual stuff that I studied and I practiced were all 14th century and before. And, you know, recently I'm starting to get beyond that. So working with the Yangti Nakpo and the Dark Retreat, which I think is phenomenal tradition and really super interesting, has gotten me over my biases about, you know, things getting boring after the 14th century. And I recognize Jigme Lingpa. Like, what a beautiful writer. I mean, you know, some of my most beautiful, Kunshok Sum Nadeshe Tsawa Sum Salun Tikle Rangshin Sem Noro Rangshin Tuche Kyoko Chanchini Papari Kevsuchi and Ho Natsu Nawa Chude Tsuriki Kora Lugu Guda Kempejo Rami Wusa Yusu Nelsa Chur Temeshi Nan Sem Kodo, which are the refuge and the bodhicitta prayers in the Longchen Nyingtyik. How beautiful. Mm-hmm. I mean, those are just really beautiful. So I admire that about him. I also admire his creativity in thinking about sadhanas and trying to rethink them and so forth. It's just not really my cup of tea. It's not what I'm that interested by. And so I'm not quite sure how the tradition holds him, but he did not reveal Longchenpa's writings at all. I mean, it's not that Longchenpa's writings were somehow missing and Jigme Lingpa came along and said, oh, here they are. Rather, I think, you know, there was a claim, and I'm not the expert on Jigme Lingpa, I'm not the best person to ask that question, that he was discerning the true intent of Longchenpa's, you know, writings and thoughts. And so his own expressions were, in that sense, understood as further revelations in that vein. But I don't think anybody was trying to say that he, like all these writings that we have of Longchenpa, it's not like Jigme Lingpa re-revealed them. I mean, Jigme Lingpa did his own revelations, and then there was the claim that they were associated or inspired by Longchenpa as well. So, but I'm not the best person to ask that question.
Okay, great, thanks. There's another question turning to your current work. In your work concerning Buddha nature as executive director of the Contemplative Sciences Center at the University of Virginia, are you working predominantly with contemplative practitioners or with scholars or with both? For instance, what may be the place for long-term practitioners who work with translated texts or whose academic specialties lie outside Tibetan studies in particular?
So I would say the majority of the work we've done in the Contemplative Science Center has been applied work to date. It's about a 10 or 11 year history. And our biggest project has been in elementary schools, actually. We sponsored one of the largest projects ever done in North America in elementary school education in the city of Louisville, Kentucky. It's called the Compassionate Schools Project. It was a big effort to build a curriculum with Tish Jennings and Alexis Harris for bringing contemplative practices into a K-5 environment. And then we worked with Patrick Tolan and others on doing this big randomized control trial with 20,000 kids, the results of which are just coming out this year. So that's a big project that we've been working on. But the more sustained effort we've been doing is with higher education. So thinking about how do we take a chemistry class or a physics class or a history class or an economics class or an astronomy class, and what would it look like to bring contemplation and contemplative principles into that class? It can involve doing practices, but it can also involve much more wide-ranging thoughts about how do you do contemplative assessments, contemplative assignments? What does a contemplative classroom environment look like? How does a teacher conduct themselves contemplatively and so forth? So we do a lot of work with that. We do a lot of work with co-curricular programs, extracurricular programs, fraternities, sororities, residential life. It's really an attempt to think about the entire structure of higher education and how contemplation and contemplative principles and contemplative values can help us reassess what we're doing at a time when young people are suffering from a historic degradation of well-being, which is what's going on, if you haven't noticed. I mean, basically, every measure we have of the well-being of youth is crashing. Anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicidal ideation, suicide, et cetera. One out of every four kids in high school in the U.S. tries to kill themselves, who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, et cetera. One out of, I think, 8% of all kids across all categories try to kill themselves during high school, et cetera. It's the second leading cause of death amongst undergraduates in American colleges. So in the face of that, that's really what motivates me personally to work with the contemplative science stuff, is how can we engage in transformation in ways that can help address that situation of suffering, but also address the potential and the capacity for understanding and growth amongst our young people. Personally now, I'm trying to kind of work more towards my own roots, which are a deep involvement with scholarship, and also with historic traditions like Tibetan Buddhism and so forth, and think about how can we galvanize that work and people who teach in that, who transmit traditions, who have deep understandings of the literature, et cetera. How can we galvanize those people to help contribute to this other realm, this realm that's outside of our Buddhist transmitted lineages and so forth, like in public school systems or HR firms of companies and so forth. And what I've come up with recently as the way that I'm trying to do that, and I'm trying to work with other practitioners and teachers and scholars, is what I call the generative contemplation initiative. And the idea behind this is to think about contemplation as a generative capacity rather than as a series of products that are shrink-wrapped that we have to transmit over time. And so the idea would be, when we look at language, we know it's generative. Like, you don't learn English or Tsongkha or Tibetan by memorizing a bunch of speeches. You learn principles that allow you to be generative. You learn vocabulary, you learn grammar, you learn context, and then you can go out and you can generate spoken and written language that's appropriate for the context, like we're doing right now. So what if we thought of contemplative traditions as generative in that way, as something that in Tibet, they had a deep fluency and literacy and contemplation that allowed them to generate endlessly varied forms of contemplation over time, whether one teacher teaching karma in one way and David in another way, or a tradition having 55 different variations of a practice that are constantly dynamically changing over time. Like, what if we thought of contemplation like that? Then the question would be, what are the building blocks of contemplation, the equivalent of a language vocabulary? Like, you know, all the little pieces that go into forming a contemplation. And then what's the equivalent of a grammar of contemplation? Like, what are the ways that someone who's fluent in Tibetan Buddhist contemplation just knows instinctively how you can put these together or how you can't put them together, even though they can't necessarily explain it? Just like, I mean, I think if you ask Karma or I, you know, like, oh, explain how you're using English, we'd be like, I haven't studied grammar for a while, you know? I mean, that's not, I don't do that. I'm not a grammarian. So I can speak English fluently, but I can't actually explain to you how the grammar works. So how do we explain that grammar? Then finally, the context, like time and space and philosophical context and all these contexts that animate contemplative systems. So that's my project these days. It's a very large project with others, to look at Tibetan Buddhism initially, although ultimately I'd like to go beyond Tibetan Buddhism. But for me, that's what I know well in this world. And look at historic forms of these practices and contemporary forms, and look at all the variations of a given practice, and then try to understand what are the vocabularies, the grammars, the context that constitute these. And once we have a big body of materials, we're still working on this now, then the idea is to build a design process that would allow practitioners of contemplation, but also practitioners of arts, of like the art of teaching an elementary school, or a practitioner in an HR department in a corporation, or a practitioner who's a doctor in a clinic, working together with them to design new practices that are appropriate for those forms of life in those contexts, drawing upon the fluency and literacy, but not actually translating a practice, not adapting a practice, not secularizing a practice, but rather generating a practice that's consonant with some of those principles.
Mm. Well, that was what I want to ask you. It's my last question about how the Dzogchen teachings, the Dzogchen practices actually can be made more relevant to the wider world beyond the academic circles, beyond the circles of Tibetan Buddhist practitioners. I suppose Dzogchen will take a new shape as it transmits to the Western world in the 21st century. Longchenpa had his time where he had to mold that very philosophical system, Dzogchen. Jigmelingpo probably had a very ritualistic form of Dzogchen practice based on what was happening around him. And I think Mipham definitely brought scholasticism and Dzogchen together, partly because he was responding to a very scholastic milieu. So in the same way as Dzogchen is transmitted to the West in the 21st century, as you now try to make it a more widely acceptable contemplative practice, what are the challenges? How soon would it really be able to trickle down to help, for instance, high school students or college students? What should the academics, the specialists like yourself, be prioritizing to make this process work faster? Can you explain this process, the changes that's happening and changes that would be required?
Yeah, that's what I think a lot about these days, because, you know, I have, apart from like individuals, like my family and so forth, I mean, I have three great loves in this life. And one is Tibetan people and culture, one is the Tibetan land, and one is the Tibetan Buddhist traditions, and particularly Dzogchen. I mean, those are the things I love. And like, when I'm thinking about 11th century Dzogchen Ningxik or 14th century Longchenpa's writings and so forth, I mean, love really is what comes to mind first and foremost. I couldn't tell you like these are better than some other tradition. I wouldn't say that. Like, it's like saying, hey, karma, is your mother better than my mother? You know, well, I mean, she's your mother, right? You love her and I love my mother. But so these are what I love in this life. And there are things that have a profound impact on me. Like you said early on, was, you know, was this those years spent studying after that, were they enjoyable years and so forth? I don't know about enjoyable, but they shaped who I was, and I couldn't imagine myself being different. That land and those people and those traditions gave me fundamentally important, essential ways to understand myself and the world around me. And so as I'm now in this position here at the University of Virginia, where I'm leading these efforts in the contemplative science and student flourishing, we're currently actually building a 60,000 square foot building in the middle of the campus devoted to contemplation called the Contemplative Commons. So there's an opportunity. And so I'm really asking these questions a lot, like how do we do something that's not just mindfulness and yoga 101, like everybody is doing across North America and so forth, but how can we look back at this rich heritage of our species that's done so much experimental work in things like Dzogchen and so forth, and be able to bring some of those into new forms that are appropriate for our context and our realities. Just like you said, in Tibet, they did constantly. Even though when you talk to a Tibetan teacher, they'll make it seem like it's all the same thing over so many years, but it's not what the history tells us. History tells us Tibetans were constantly innovating, constantly changing, constantly adapting to their changed circumstances. Like this morning I was reading your article about Buddhism and media, you know, so looking back at the way that media has been changing over all these years with regards to Buddhism. So I think the challenges, I mean, the approach I'm taking is what I just talked about, the generative contemplation and thinking about contemplation by design and so forth. At the personal level, I think some of the challenges I feel are that I know Tibetan people and culture and traditions obviously are under a lot of pressures over the past 50 years because of things that have happened, as we all know about. And a natural reaction to those kinds of pressures is to shut down, is to be conservative, is to resist innovation, because so much is being lost, so much has been lost, and there's so many pressures you feel arrayed against you. And so you kind of want to be conservative and lock down what's left and say, no, it's got to be like this because that's how we do it and so forth. So I think that's a challenge. And it's a challenge because, like, that's the reality of Tibetan and Bhutanese and other Himalayan people. And these are their traditions, you know, that they have created and nurtured and been intertwined with their individual and collective souls over so many centuries. And for us, I'm not Tibetan. I mean, you know, I may be the father of Tibetans, because I have three children who are half Tibetan, so I guess I have that claim to fame. But I'm not Tibetan. And so, you know, it feels problematic to, like, disagree with Tibetans who are lineage holders and so forth about what the future of these traditions might be or what one might do with them and so forth. And so I think that's a real challenge. Like, you know, are there people, are there Tibetan teachers out there, ethnically Tibetan, Bhutanese teachers, who are interested themselves in exploring these frontiers? And there are some, I know, and there are others who definitely are opposed to that. And so I think that's a big issue. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why I framed the Generative Contemplation Initiative like I did, which is, this is understanding. I don't feel bad about understanding things in a different way. But if we're not adapting, secularizing, altering, translating these practices from Tibet and Bhutan, but rather we're being inspired by how we've learned the way that they've developed contemplative fluency over so many centuries, that to me feels ethically a lot less problematic than just going in and saying, hey, I'm going to grab your practice. I know you don't like what I'm going to do with it, but I'm going to go put it over here and secularize it and use it for some other purpose. Even if my motivation is good, that feels problematic to me. And also, I'm not even sure it's really a good thing to do. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, it'd be a good thing for Bhutanese to do, like Karma Poonsok, you know, but, like, you know, karma, you're part of a living, breathing Vajrayana culture. And I'm not in America. You know, America is not a Vajrayana culture. It's not a Buddhist culture. It's a culture that's very secular, that's very Christian, and it has, you know, threads of Judaism and Islam and Buddhism and Native American religions and so forth threaded throughout. So that's a very different reality than working within Tibet or within Nepal or within Bhutan, which I'd have a very different perspective there. So I'm hopeful that over the next 5 or 10 years, as we go through this, that we will find an ever-evolving partners who are Tibetan or Bhutanese or Nepali to work with us, but that we also find people who are practitioners, who are scholars, who are people who aren't Buddhist at all, who are just interested in finding practices that can help people be more resilient, more caring, more insightful in an era where there are so many forces arrayed against us, in an era which people have called an era of toxic attention, you know, attentional toxicity, that such practices and approaches are in more need than ever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. Well, I think that's exactly why we have also started these conversations on Buddha Nature, because perhaps we need more of such positive discussions, and also encourage each other. I hope your big projects of bringing contemplative sciences to the larger society in the West, particularly in the US, will be successful. I mean, when I look at the Tibetan Buddhist heritage or the Buddhist heritage in general, I don't particularly see it as strictly associated with any particular geography or any group. It's a universal heritage. I think it would be good to respect the integrity, but I hope our leaders will also be dynamic and flexible enough to adapt to current times. Otherwise, we'll end up being irrelevant, and being irrelevant would mean gradually sort of disappearing into oblivion. And I think what you are doing through these generative contemplative practices or applied contemplative science work is extremely useful. And it's probably something that a lot of the Buddhist teachers here from the Himalayas should also start looking at to keep the timeless message going instead of remaining static and then getting lost. We have already spent over 1.5 hours. Wonderful session, and none of our, well, almost all of our audience are still with us, so they must have thoroughly enjoyed it. It was such an illuminating, eloquent, gripping talk. Thank you very, very much, David, and I hope everybody enjoyed the conversation. So with that, I think we should bring this session to a close. No, Marcus?
Yes, wonderful. Thank you all so much for being here. Thank you, Karma. Thank you, David. It was a real treat.
Yes. Wonderful. Thank you.
And okay, thanks to both of you. And I was also saying, you know, Karma, you're an inspiration, and the work that you've done at Loden and elsewhere is, I think, you know, shows a pathway forward for how traditional values and practices can be integrated with radical innovation.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, thank you so much. Good night from my side.
Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. Thank you.
Bye. Bye-bye.